I think we are working again. That's pretty nice. I only have to push one button. Well, I think you were talking about the beginning of your career after graduate school, where you went to Baylor College of Medicine and were beginning to interact with the Hornings in their laboratory there.
Never really interacted with them. In other words, I went there and did my thing, and I helped recruit Tom Desiderio and Paul Burrows.
Okay.
And they were there for a while. And they also decided it wasn't in their interest to collaborate very much with Evan. So,
what did Marjorie do?
Marjorie is a totally independent. She was semi-independent. She worked with him and by herself. She had good grants, NIH grants on metabolism and newborn infants.
Ah, okay. So you were kind of like free to do what you wanted to do there?
Yeah.
When you went there, that was because of your expertise in mass spectrometry that was attracted to them?
Yeah.
Okay. But they weren't interested in someone who's going to be a lab tech. They wanted somebody who had the skills that they could
use. That was a faculty job.
Okay.
I was an assistant professor when I moved there. And
was the NIH okay with you kind of absconding or disappearing from your Stockholm position? You know, I think you kind of suggested that you were going to...
Yeah, no, that there wasn't any problem there. I just said, you know, I've got other things to do. I'd forgotten we were there so long. Stockholm's not a bad place.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some strangenesses to it.
They were still driving on the other side.
Well, they're still driving on the left. I was there, I visited there once, 1 week after they moved from the left side to the right side.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Whoa.
That must have been exciting.
Uh-huh. They called it H-Day. The word is horrid or something like that for a guy.
Uh-huh.
And they told me, road accidents just went to zero.
Yeah.
People just were so up on this.
So careful.
Saying, whoa, I don't trust myself to do anything.
Yeah.
And that was the problem. It was a question of reflexes.
Yeah.
You get into a traffic circle, and you need to make a quick right in that moment.
Yeah. So you were...
Okay, so Baylor, let's see...
You were still interested in nucleosides and nucleotides.
Yeah. And we published some very good papers in that period. Kind of more basic mass spectrometry. I say basic. Not in the field in Franklin sense, but understanding fragmentation pathways and the like.
Mm-hmm.
That worked well. But at the same time, we became rather experienced in microscale derivatization, so that your route into getting useful data was still to make a derivative, because many of the things you work with, whether you're working at a monomer level, that is nucleosides or up nucleotides, whatever, you can't deal with, so you need to become volatile. And so there are ways to do that through methylation was one.
So what part of the...
Silylation was one.
What part of the molecule got derivatized? Was ice or something?
Both the sugar and the base.
Okay. You could do either one or both.
You can, yeah. What you want to do is probably do both and drive the reaction far enough that you know what you have, and which is to do both. If you stop in the middle or something goes wrong and you've got 30% of the bases aren't derivatized and the rest of them are, oh my gosh.
Uh-huh.
And it's a mixture.
Uh-huh.
You'll end up spending your life counting the peaks and stuff like that.
So we use the silanization. Use like I think tetramethylsilane was a or trimethylsilane. Well, there's a, some couple of silanes.
Yeah. Trimethyl. Well, it was trimethylsilyl acetamide.
Ah, okay.
So called BSA, and then there's one called BSTFA, which is more powerful silanating reagent. And we actually got pretty good at that, and because we were starting to work then increasingly on real unknown structures,
mm-hmm.
just not known. And so it was necessary in those cases to make a derivative and understand the spectrum that you get. And if the structure is really, truly not known,
mm-hmm.
then you can get a lot of mileage out of that. But the problem still was initially that you had to be one step away from a mixture. Could isolate it, or somebody could isolate it. And
was chromatography part of and, act in this?
Not yet. No, that was a later. That was a later thing. That was where the Festech days.
Uh-huh.
And I became at that time also. I began to have serious long-term interactions with a Japanese scientist named Nishimura.
How do you spell that, please?
Nishimura. Nishimura. First name is Susumu. S-U-M-U.
S-U?
S-U. S-U. Again, M-U. Susumu. S-U-S-U.
S-U-S-U.
M-U.
S-U-S-U-M-U. Susumu.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you meet up with this gentleman?
That's an interesting question. Let me think about that. My recollection is that he contacted me somehow. He was interested in modified nucleosides, natural nucleosides that were modified.
Okay.
And there were a lot of them in transfer RNA. The structures weren't known. And someone had put the bee in his bonnet that mass spectrometry might be a useful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we were already starting a lot down that line. And so, mm-hmm.
So you had some publications that he would have tripped over in the literature that would have...
Yeah. Plus, of course he has dozens upon dozens of papers. He's very prolific.
Mm-hmm.
He was very prolific. But he gave great... he was very interested in micro-scale methods because it was a gold to the biochemist who trying to isolate things from RNA. And although they got very good at it, what do you want? I want a microgram of stuff clean.
Mm-hmm. Clean. Now, very clean.
Now wait a minute. Two problems there. One is you want a microgram.
Yeah.
The second is you want it clean.
You want it clean.
And sometimes we got it and he could do it because he would do isolations from tRNA on a very large scale.
Mm.
So I began going to visit him, and...
This is Slayer, still at Baylor College of Medicine.
Still at Baylor, and multiple visits. I must have gone dozens of times.
Where was he in Japan?
He was at the National Cancer Center Research Institute.
In the city?
Of Tokyo. Right in the middle of it.
So how was your, you went to Japan, what was your impression of your first time there?
Well, it was interesting because those were early days then, and the Japanese had not ascended to the lofty place they were when they had all these financial troubles.
Mm-hmm.
Before they became famous for being better than we and,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. So it was interesting, and I've got an interesting picture, I don't know where it is, Kay, of the group picture of his group, the National Cancer Center, one year, and there were 100 people, and it's a whole institute, 80 people or something like that.
Well, there was one of you and Yang Yang.
One foreigner, so mm-hmm. a little face stands out, but it wasn't that way 15 years later, there were a lot of foreigners. Mm-hmm. So I was the only one. And it was kind of fun because it was a real adventure. It was just an out-and-out adventure. And I became fairly familiar with getting around in Tokyo and what to do and how to do it. And, you know, things that made me more relaxed.
Yeah.
And to learn, for example, that you can never become lost.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If you think you're lost, stop somebody. Mm-hmm. Whatever, it's so easy. People fall all over themselves trying to help you.
Oh, wow.
And you never, you know, there are places in Europe where you get lost.
Oh, yeah.
And say, I'm lost. You know? And so that is helpful for a foreigner in particular who doesn't speak.
So we're, at this time of your initial, visits to Japan, were you like, did you see very many Westerners there?
No, very, very few.
So you were kind of...
I wasn't around the tourists, you see.
Ah.
I was in the National Cancer Center Hospital and all of that. And occasionally I'd see somebody's Italian post office or something.
Uh-huh.
We would eye each other and nod. But you know, secret handshakes. Anyway, those were exciting days, and science was coming along nicely.
So what did he bring to your collaboration? Did he bring making these compounds?
We scratched each other's back in a furious fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So he would isolate compounds or mixtures that had compounds in them of unknown structure, and we would work on the structures.
Okay.
And sometimes a little bit was known, sometimes much less was known, and we would deliver a full structure, a complete structure. Sometimes we could make it and prove it, synthesize
the classical.
Or not. I mean, it depends on what you know. And what position did it come from in the transfer RNA?
Mm-hmm.
What's known about the variation in that position and other things that would give you confidence that your assignment was probably correct.
Mm-hmm. So the size of these molecules at this time was on the order of a couple hundred?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was volatility an issue?
300. We were derivatizing at that point, and so we got fairly good at it, and we could do okay. But the whole thing loosened up enormously after LC-MS became possible. Wow. And I thought we had the bull by the horns.
I have no idea what that is. Probably.
That's the iron source we swiped from them. On there. I think that's what that is. That's a quadrupole.
So you were doing this work on a mass spectrometer in...
So in
Baylor.
At our place, right. They did finally get a mass spectrometer in Tokyo. That's me and Pam and
Susan.
Matsumoto.
No, that's Susan.
Oh, Susan, sorry.
You didn't have your glasses on. That's Matsumoto.
No, that's...
No, that's Sassy Boyama's husband.
No. Here's a picture of one of these meetings I went to in Kyoto with Ragnar Rihaga.
Oh, that is Ragnar. Yeah.
This is Ragnar.
Uh-huh.
And that's me. And what I'm looking for is the big picture.
I had the whole
cancer center. Anyway, there's Mike DeBakey.
And Martha.
Oh, giving a PhD to my student, Martha, correct.
No, I don't know. Oh, skipping ahead 20 years by going back into here. This is contemporary.
That may be in Gus's book.
It could be contemporary Utah stuff. So, so I had a long way to go to learn things about the biology of RNA. And even at the time I started on it, it was not recognized about the widespread importance of RNA. It was known to be no kind of a mirror of DNA. Mm-hmm. You have DNA here and you have RNA here and you have transfer RNA and you have ribosomal RNA. Since then, in recent years, it's become RNA is a master molecule controlling all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not full big RNAs, they're little RNAs doing this, and it's become a big thing. I never worked with those,
mm-hmm.
but we worked with the big ones. We don't have a poster here, do we, Kay? I should have a poster. But I don't. And the structures, remember all of them?
It's somewhere. The RNA poster?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We had one. Maybe even before. Anyway, so I began to learn more about why they were doing these things, which made it much more interesting to me. But
sure.
I found out that I could never do their work well at all.
Mm-hmm.
I went there and spent months and months trying to learn to isolate things and
mm-hmm.
do this and that. And the skill required to do something that is so high that you could read about what to do and do it and find out that you can't find the product or it's mm-hmm. lost or it's gummed up or it's...
So this was all kind of wet chemistry kind of stuff that they were doing?
Yeah, wet chemistry to isolate something from a large molecule and put it over. Do multiple chromatographies to get it pure and so forth. But it became clear to me that in those days that a method where you could use chromatography seriously
mm-hmm.
in conjunction with mass spectrometry,
mm-hmm.
not just you know, the day before, but oh, here we go.
And now you're talking GC or LC?
Well, it turned out to be LC. There's the classic characters.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Absorb
like
that?
It looks like, yeah, I can absorb that. That's, we might have to take a picture of that later. Looks like a spider landed on there with ink on its feet.
Yeah. No, so we published that and printed it. So it turned out that we figured that at the time I quit doing this stuff that we had contributed seriously to 20% of the known structures. Those are the known structures.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some real interesting molecules in there.
Yeah.
Really interesting. And
so you kind of had to rely on them to do the wet chemistry and isolate.
Well, to isolate it until we reached the point where we could take crude RNA and isolate it ourselves. We could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Pam Crane worked with me for years. You
mm-hmm.
know Pam.
Mm-hmm.
And she became very good at the isolations. And she could isolate an RNA that had the goods in it that we wanted. And then you enzymatically degraded
mm-hmm.
something, nucleosides or nucleotides or whatever, and then perform on that LC-MS.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when electrospray really came into its own.
Mm-hmm.
You could work with some real
mm-hmm.
small amounts of material, and you know what you could get out of it, and it was just... It was marvelous. So that was, and we're reaching a point where people, I'd meet people and said, you know, maybe Arthur, have you not discovered all the nucleosides in RNA? You know, you see this list here. And then I'd say, well, probably not. And I think that was correct. There are minor variations of these. You could go on forever, but I don't see any major point in it.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing would be if there are new families. And so there are a couple of major new families that I was involved in and that we had solved.
Major new families of RNA?
Nucleosides in RNA.
Nucleosides in RNA.
I will show you some. Let's see.
most famous is Q. There is Q. So you see, what you have here are bases connected to sugars.
Uh-huh.
Sugars are mostly ribose, but not always. The bases are sometimes simple, sometimes methylated, sometimes more elaborate, a lot like that. Oh, here's Q. This became a poster child because we worked on the structure and solved it mostly by mass spectrometry. You see, it looks like a purine.
Mm.
It looks like guanine, but there's no nitrogen here.
Mm.
Whoa, wait a minute. See, you should have a nitrogen in that position.
Mm.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you have a family where there is no nitrogen at position 7. Mm. It's a carbon and goes into your unique side chain.
Oh, wow.
Then there are more.
Ouch.
Then there are more. And then here are the precursors, biological precursors. So it generated a nest of other work to do to find out what the route was to making Q. And then here's one.
Is this still hot? I mean, is that still active, that website?
I don't think so. You know, it should be. What we did was we shut it down when I left, and somebody called me and said...
Those are all transfer RNAs?
No, these are from all RNAs. The modified nucleotides of RNA, from all kinds of RNA. And I can give you the current URL for what they're doing. So I kind of gave it away to a guy in North Carolina who was interested in it. And I probably shouldn't have done that quite so blithely. But he now has taken it over.
Uh-huh.
If I can find the URL for it somewhere.
Well, it'd be good to include in here. So, I mean, basically, it's through your work with this Japanese collaborator that all of this information...
Yeah, much of it.
Is...
A chunk of it.
A big chunk.
When I started working with him, probably half of these were known.
Mm-hmm.
And we together worked on most of the other half.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are really killers. One of them is one called archaeocene, which is probably one of the best things I've done. And we wanted to give you a list of papers that were notable. And where is archaeocene? There's a G+. We gave it the symbol of G+. It too has no nitrogen here.
Uh-huh.
But then what's on there looks like the fork of the amino acid arginine. So it's charged. And it's just fascinating. That is in one whole kingdom, evolutionary kingdom. That nucleoside is very common in its tRNA. Almost all the tRNAs from every organism have it.
Hmm.
And that's what led us on. We said, whoa. This is universal. And we were at that time we were getting interested in another angle for all this, and that was the difference between the three major branches of life.
Mm.
Living things, there are three kinds of living things. Bacteria, eukaryotes, and archaea. ARCHAEA.
Mm-hmm.
And so there would be debates going on about where do you put the branch of the tree and how does this, all kinds of questions. But I became very interested in that. So we would follow some of these things by going out on the branches of the tree to see what we found and were they related to the position of the branch or another large segment that we got into was working with thermophiles. And I got in with collaborated a lot with a microbiologist in Regensburg, Germany, named Karl with a K, Stetter, S-T-E-T-T-E-R,
S-T-E.
T-T-E-R.
Stetter.
Yeah.
Carl?
Carl.
With
a C or a K. Who is one of the...
Why did you want
to... one of the hot shots.
How did you get... What's? I mean, thermophiles or...
Someone recommended him to me because I was working on the edge of the... Just in that family. Or K on the branch. I'll show you a map. What it looks like. And a well-known person in that field said to me, you know, you really should work with... You really should meet Carl Stetter.
Okay.
He is a young guy in Germany. Isn't that young?
I mean, he's my age. So young.
My age. And worked on hot organisms.
Yeah, you, sure.
You grow them for us. Mm. So we had a number of these that we grew once or twice ourselves. Otherwise, we had someone grow them. And that was painful. We could get out the RNA ourselves and start working at that level. And but some of these are really unusual organisms, and they're hard to come by, hard to culture, very difficult to culture. But because of the temperatures at which they operate, some of them can grow successfully at above the temperature, above the boiling point of water.
Wow.
Above the boiling point. Water.
That's weird.
Now that means on the ocean floor, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, not as bad. And so you're not at that temperature. So it turns out there are modifications like this that are virtually unique to those organisms.
I would imagine so.
Yeah. Well, it turned out there are. We didn't know that. And we discovered a bunch of them that are. And we determined their structures, and we were able to relate the structures to their resistance to degradation at high temperature.
Mm.
That's where you really want to go. Mm. You have lots of structures, but what are they doing?
So you're getting to a structure-property relationship.
Getting to the structure-function relationship. And I had a grant once that was from NIH where they said, you know, Dr. McCluskey, it's really very... whatever it was, amazing that you've determined all these structures, but what are they good for?
Mm.
And I thought, God, that's an insulting thing to say.
Yeah.
And then I thought, what are they good for? Some we know what they're good for, some we don't know what they're good for. We don't know the positions. You've got to know the sequence position to make sense out of that. And just because you know the sequence position doesn't mean you can infer function.
So this is all while you're at Baylor.
No, this is, I left all that. This was after I moved to Utah.
Okay, so.
Pretty much after I moved.
Yeah, okay. So, do we want to, is there anything else at Baylor? I mean, did you first get, you met the Japanese guy at Baylor?
I did. I did. And I went to work in his lab, actually, for 6 months.
In Japan?
In Tokyo. And I had a year off from Baylor, and the other 6 months was at was in the chemistry department at the University of Utah.
Oh.
And of course, that was a deadly thing to let me do because the Utah people, especially in the College of Pharmacy, opened their arms and said, "Whoa, brother!" Mm-hmm.
Now, somewhere near Marvin Bestel fits is was that
he was a Marvin Bestel was a collaborator of sorts at that time of people in the chemistry department.
In Utah?
Yes.
Because he ended up going to Houston, right?
No, that's after. That's yeah. So he became a graduate student of Gene Futrelle.
Right.
And that was here. Gene was a professor here.
Here in?
Utah.
In Utah.
In chemistry. So Marvin became his student.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a joke going around about the fact the student of Gene's had more publications than Gene did. Which may have been true, but that doesn't tell you an awful lot.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was a highly accomplished, respected, well-known chemist. More dealing more with fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. And Marvin. Yeah.
And then, but Marvin had talents for dealing with instrumentation. And at a time when mass spectrometry's progress, its explosion onto the scene, was carried largely by radically new instrumentation, he was in the right place at the right time,
mm-hmm.
period.
Mm-hmm.
So he then got a PhD at the University of Utah, and I have to look at his CV.
I think he ended up in Houston.
Yeah, he then went to the University of Houston, and then formed the Best Tech Corporation,
mm-hmm.
and sold mass spectrometers. And finally then left.
Right, so
that up.
Okay.
And now is kind of a consultant or something.
Mm-hmm. So back at Baylor, you had your first interaction with this Japanese fellow there, but then you carried that relationship on
forward
for the rest of your...
Rather extensive, yeah.
Okay. And then was there anything else that you did at Baylor that we need to cover at this particular point in time besides you were...
Well, I had an association, some cross-publication, but mostly not. It was Don Desiderio,
mm-hmm.
and Paul Vuros. Who had independent reputations outside of...
So they were there on the faculty. Now, what you were on the faculty...
I was on the faculty, and I recruited them.
Okay, and recruited them as faculty members.
Yes. And followed my track into the Institute for Lipid Research, bankrolled by Evan Horning's efforts.
And when you say faculty, did you guys teach anything, or was it all research?
Mostly research, but there was no undergraduate degree.
Sure, no, yeah. Yeah.
So most of it, in those days, most of it was just research. I do a little bit of stuff at Rice from time to time.
So that, like an adjunct professor type thing?
No, not even that much. And I had students who would take their courses at Rice.
Okay.
So if they got a PhD under me, they had nowhere to go to get fundamental courses.
Yeah.
So we would farm them out to Rice, and they would take PChem, for example,
mm-hmm.
as a leading, and certain courses in organic chemistry.
So there was a kind of informal relationship between Rice and the Institute of Medicine?
Yes.
So they were okay with that?
Yeah. So what happened, what was...
There's some critter out there.
Those are
our girls. You want some food?
I'll go see. We have guinea fowl.
Oh, Kay is standing on the table.
Waiting.
Yeah, we like you come out. Get him some seed.
What kind of birds are these?
Look out the door. Open the door and look out. Guinea fowl.
Oh, guinea fowl. Oops.
It's open. It's open.
It is.
Turn it hard.
There we go. Where are they? Oh, there they are. Wow. Lunch time.
Yeah. Hi, hon. Kay's coming.
Food's on the way.
They're family members.
I see.
They look like birds, but they're family members.
I see. Crazy.
Yeah. So
these two guys, basically, you were in a total research environment. You didn't have to deal with classwork or teaching.
Very little, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then
I still had students. Graduate students who would get PhDs in biochemistry.
Okay.
Honking a little bit. But it taught me early on that if I wanted to get things done, I would do it with postdocs.
Ah.
So I had, in general, more postdocs than graduate students. And once again, with the usual advantages of postdocs, then they come educated and ready to roll.
Uh-huh.
While the graduate students, you have to teach, they have courses to take, they have another...
They're pretty insistent.
Yeah. Hi, sweetie. Kay's got the thud. Go up there to Kay. Come on up to Kay. White Breast is running up the driveway. Go with Kay, she'll give you some seed. Oh, this is White Breast, sorry. White Breast is here. There goes Kay. Follow Kay. Confuse them to hear my voice from inside. They know my voice. I can go outside at any time of the day, in the evening in particular, just call them.
Oh, really?
And, oh, they'll come from long distances. They'll come. They'll run down the street and come in the driveway. So we have a lot of fun.
Soon as we're at Desiderio and Boros
to
the institute there.
The institute, but we rarely collaborated. Paul Boros and I did some interesting things on response on photographic emulsions, photographic plates, to ions of the same mass but different structure. That was so interesting.
Oh, wow. That's pretty subtle.
It was fascinating. Oh, there's some real differences. And we began to look at that, but decided there wasn't anything that we could make.
This was because of your using
confirmation. One is balled up, and the other is stretched out, and you can.
Wow! But you were doing. You were using the 110 for this, or what kind of instrument were you using for you? A photographic detector? Or?
Oh, for that. Well, we raised the money for a MAT 731.
Okay.
And we had a 110. Yes, we had a 110. We bought a 110 right after I went there. But we had raised the money then for a MAT 731, which is a really nice instrument.
This is a photographic detection
recording.
Okay.
And so we worked with that for quite a long time, and we did the electrospray, lots of FAM, and so on and so on. But then,
so you could actually tell the difference between a structure that was tightly coiled and one that was extended, but based on the
darkness of the plate.
Darkness of the photo plate, even though the ions had the same mass, and obviously then the same energy.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
And he and I realized we were really getting into kind of new territory here.
Yeah.
But we published a paper. But we weren't sure where it would go.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we can even do more of it, but we had no thesis. What is our basic thesis here?
Yes.
Is it related to structure and charge density?
Mm-hmm.
Probably. And charge shape? In other words, where is the charge? Is it over here or is it spread out? But even if we did all those things, it wasn't clear that we had. We're on a fundamentally different thing, but it worked anyway.
And this was structurally the nucleosides.
No, these were not nucleosides, not nucleic acid things at all. I'll show you the pictures. I'll show you the pictures. There are all kinds of molecules.
Of what kind?
All kinds.
Of I'm sorry.
Molecules.
Oh, all kinds of molecules.
Not nucleic acid.
Oh, okay.
And just have them in different same mass, different
Okay, so this is really a side thing.
Yeah, we had fun with that.
So was that the extent of your collaboration with these guys?
Yeah, I think it was. I never published anything with Dom Desiderio from the Baylor days.
What was he doing there? What was Desiderio doing?
Well, he was recruited into that operation just like Boros was. And I recruited them to come into that operation. And they proceeded independently.
Okay.
And they operated, as far as I know, pretty much off of grants at Evans. NIH grants. Which is, after all, what I did. And we were very successful with it. And he realized, too, that when he goes to get these grants renewed, having strong publication records from people not working closely with them
mm-hmm. you know, really very different thing, mm-hmm. Could be an advantage, could be seen as an advantage.
So having a diversity of projects was better than just being...
Yeah, you know, if it's NIGMS, mm-hmm. the National Institute of General Medical Sciences, mm-hmm. if it's the National Cancer Institute, mm-hmm. That's different. Mm-hmm. Whereas the cancer...
Yeah.
Relatedness of this work. And
so he was going to a specific branch of NIH primarily, Horning.
No, a lot of it was general medical science.
Okay,
that's
medical.
What got us into it. But he had money to do pharmacology from other branches. And we got to a point where one of my grants, which was a structure grant, doing structures of nuclear science, had gotten to a point after about its 20th year, 15th year.
Mm-hmm.
They called me up one day, NIH, and said, you know, Dr. McCloskey, we're looking at your publication recommendations for NIH and this kind of stuff. But we think you are not a good fit for, at that time, that was a cancer grant.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a good fit for the National Cancer Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I'd gone that direction, but I had originally. He said, we would like to move it. And I said, be my guest. And they said, okay, it will happen. And so they moved my grant. Just never knew it would happen. You never knew it happened. But this funding source was from one pocket to another pocket. And it became broader in that sense.
So they liked the work and thought it needed to be funded, but they didn't want to put the bill.
They didn't want to pay the bill out of their pocket.
Out of their pocket.
Each institute has their own goals and priorities,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are broad,
mm-hmm.
and some of them are less so.
But they didn't say, you're not doing what we want, so we're going to turn off the funds.
that's a difference.
Yeah.
That's a sad story
yeah.
if that happens. That means that you've not done well with
yeah.
with. Reviews,
uh-huh.
but it turns out at one time there was a close association between nucleoside modification and cancer,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
both because they're modified nucleosides from tumors that are different, and because modified nucleosides became anti-cancer agents,
mm-hmm.
were being used as anti-cancer agents. So my work on modified nucleosides would fit under their umbrella.
Yes.
Until finally one day they said, it's not, you know, we have so many things to fund,
yeah.
and this one has moved out a little bit. Why don't you? He says, I've talked to the NIGMS person, and they'd be delighted to fund it.
So they moved you over into the National Institute of General Medical Science.
Right.
Okay.
And I stayed there.
Okay. Wait, and now this was after you'd moved to Utah?
Yes.
So I just
want to stay there kind of forever.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we've wrapped up anything of importance or interest at Baylor before we get up to Utah. And I don't know, you talked about it, you know, kind of recruiting a couple of people there. And this is where you got connected with the Japanese researcher that you spent a lot of time mm-hmm. with.
And that, of course, continued and so forth and so on.
Why did you decide to go to Utah?
Well, that's an interesting question. it didn't have to be, in the sense that there was nothing special about Utah. And if I held on long enough, I probably could find a position in some other university. Because Mass Spectrometry was just getting a toehold
mm-hmm.
in 19... What was it, Kay? When did we move to Utah?
We moved to Utah in 74.
74.
And
other things looked very good about it. I would have freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I had research freedom.
But you were a tenured professor at at Baylor.
Yes.
So you would be moving with tenure.
As a full professor.
As a full professor, okay. To Utah.
Yeah. And I did that.
And
there was money to fund me through Evans grants. And those were not the days where you said, you know, I lost all my grants. It didn't happen in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, to answer your question, that was the attraction was that there was funding, enormous freedom to do what I wanted, and they really liked what I did, liked what they saw in me.
So did they kind of recruit you, or, I mean...
Yeah, they did. There was a job open, and I wrote to them and said, oh, we really would like to talk to you. Why don't you come see us?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, let's see, where was I? Was I in Paris? Where was I?
Well, we came through there in Japan, from Japan.
I don't remember.
We went to Japan in 72 from Baylor. We spent...
There was an interview trip to Baylor.
You mean not to Baylor?
To Utah.
The medical school in Houston had not yet started up, and the one in San Antonio was just in the early stages in 74.
Mm-hmm.
So those two were, you know, kind of in limbo as far as what they...
Yeah.
There would have been an opportunity, but it was...
Yeah.
So there was a chance to stay in this area and go to some new institutes that were starting up in Texas, but, I mean...
Far down the road.
By leaving Texas, well, there's two stages here. One is what attracted me to Baylor. And then there's what attracted me to leave Baylor and go to the University of Utah. And so what we were really discussing was the Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I had some interests similar to theirs. They had people, long history in that department that I went to, the Department of Medicinal Chemistry, in nucleoside synthesis. And I think they believed that if we are interested in nucleoside synthesis, man, grants, big time grants,
mm-hmm.
that having a person with credentials and doing mass spectrometry on these molecules wouldn't be bad at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I agree with you, and I've got your people to talk to. And I came up and I thought, well, those are gorgeous mountains. I didn't realize that you had to shovel snow.
Yeah. Mountains are pretty, but it was summertime.
I found that out later on. The one had to get rid of the snow in the driveway. So that was anyway the theme that was attractive.
And so the University of Utah is in
Salt Lake City. Yeah.
Okay.
So we moved to.
Now, did you take any grants with you?
I took no grants with me.
No grants.
So the issue was there. I thought it was unfair for me to attempt to take money with me.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had raised the money as a joint effort. Boros,
mm-hmm.
Desiderio, Ornings, and other people there. And I thought, this is crazy. Plus, the instruments were not spring chickens.
Mm.
So I thought, perhaps a few people said, well, this is foolish. But I did it, nevertheless. I can raise the money and get new ones, new instruments.
So basically,
more modern instruments.
No, okay. So you showed up at Utah with no grants and no instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And did they have any instruments on site there at the time from their own efforts? Okay.
I didn't have a dime.
Okay. So you were kind of, you know, betting on the come.
Something, didn't he?
Well, Gene Futrell, yeah, that's a different department. But not in my area. And so I said, well, I immediately cast out for money.
Oh, yeah.
I went to NIGMS initially. Maybe.
And Pam moved.
And Pam moved. Pam Crane had worked with me at the Baylor College of Medicine. And she was a BS level person. And but I convinced her she should come to Utah.
Mm-hmm.
So she came and got a job. We managed to make her a research associate, which is normally a postdoc's title.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, she's doing the postdoc's work, so let's do that. And I paid her, and she's paid by my grants. And so Pam came, and we launched the whole thing, applied for new money, and got it. Bing, was that helpful? That was for a 110.
Mm.
And although some people felt that was old science you're dealing with here,
My response was, yes, but we're familiar with it.
We know
exactly what we're getting into.
You can get the ball running.
Very fast if we're dealing with that mass spectrometer. And we needed, of course, a densitometer
sure.
to the plates.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. People forget that, right?
Oh, yeah.
The unknown parameter is that you've got to have a densitometer for automatic reading, and you need the programs
mm-hmm.
and all of that. So we got the money for the densitometer, bought it from the same place, the only ones, I guess, at that time were really selling them. And we got the software from Baylor. I mean, it's written under my jurisdiction anyway. Mm-hmm. And changed it so that we could use it at Utah.
So you had actually had some software development at Baylor. You had people working for you to do that, to get the automatic transfer of the mass spec down from a photographic plate.
Yeah, and we did other things too. We were into some interpretation rules mm-hmm. using computers and the like. And I had a programmer working for me.
So it was a time frame when everyone was kind of doing their own thing because there wasn't that much out there in mm-hmm. terms of software if you wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wasn't trying to invent any new wheels here. Let's get it out.
Get the data.
Get it running very fast. And I had proposals, after all, to do certain kinds of work in NIH grant. Writing software de novo was one of my plans.
Yeah.
I can see the merit in it.
Oh, yeah.
Great merit. Yeah.
So did, I mean...
merits if you're trying to move fast.
Yeah. No, they had I thought they put an electrical detection scheme on the 110 at one time. Is that my...
Yeah,
imagine?
No. They had one. Yes.
So did you get it with that electrical detection as well? Or,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And,
so you weren't bound to the photo plate.
And they had also put an EI source on it.
Yes.
And
we had it just an EI source.
Just an EI
to start with.
Okay.
But the fact is that, you know, coming through the MIT, halls of MIT, mm-hmm. I was already, you know, tinged with the photo plate idea.
Mm-hmm.
Although it was clear after very long that there are other ways to go.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it has certain advantages.
It's an integrating detector.
Yeah.
So that gives you some sensitivity.
Do things at different points and still gather the data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be true. And we could work with real mixtures.
Mm-hmm.
Hairy, hairy mixtures. Whether you move the plate or not between exposures. You may move the plate or you may keep it in the same location and continue to collect data. There's various ways to do it. We got fairly adept at doing all those things.
It sounds to me like money came pretty easily in this era. I mean, it seems like if you had established yourself and had the credentials and had the problems that were of interest to the funding agency, you got it. Now you were a graduate from Klaus Biemann's group. I assume that all those people had kind of like I don't know what you want to call it, extra recognition.
Yeah.
In the community.
And I had been at Baylor then for 10 years and published a fair number of papers at Baylor. So the track I was on looked fairly good. For a guy who's moved without any grant money and has tenure, but so
that's kind of risky in a way.
Has tenure, but so what?
Yeah.
Well, it was risky, and I didn't realize the level of risk.
Maybe it's a good thing.
Until I looked at it hard in the process of getting it reviewed, thinking, wait a minute, if this goes south,
we got big time problems.
what have we got going on here? And it did not go south. It was successful. And then it was renewed multiple times. That grant ran for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The initial grant ran for 30 years. And that ended when I left the University of Utah in
74. Mm-hmm. That was year 30. Was coming to a wind down.
No. Okay, you left there in 74?
Yeah. 74. Okay. Oh, no.
74.
Yes, to come here.
Oh, okay. So that was a pretty gussy move.
74 to 2007.
To be in Utah.
You're in Utah from 74 to 2007.
Okay, you started.
In Utah is retirement. Ah. So retirement is total wind down.
Yeah, that's 2000 recently.
That's 2007
or whatever.
Seven.
Okay, so you started in Utah in 74.
No. Yeah.
Yes. And you ended up getting funding and getting going. And how long did it take you to get underway? I mean, you got to wait for money. You got to get the instrument. You got to get yourself running.
All those things.
Yeah, it took a year or two, didn't it?
Yes, it took a year plus, and I had manpower because I moved with Pam mm-hmm. Crane moved, mm-hmm. and so I had. People, and they agreed to pay her initially.
Yeah, because they didn't have any money.
They're going to pay her. That's right. So that worked out pretty well.
Now you're in a true university environment, though, in terms of education. So were you required to do any teaching?
Yes.
Okay.
And I did some teaching, and I spent more time with academic things, like I ran the seminar program for a few years, mm-hmm. and I had another thing. There was a committee started under me that ran or monitored or whatever all the graduate programs in the college, and I was chairman of that for 15 years.
All the graduate programs mm-hmm.
in the College of Pharmacy.
In the College of Pharmacy, okay.
There are five departments.
Okay.
So it was the Graduate Programs Committee, it was called. And I found out I spent a fair amount of time at that, actually, when I quit it. But that was fine. It played out. It had its uses at a time when there are departments are falling down on one side or another, and we give them a boost. And we had some, get-togethers where they could talk to each other, sort of. So, in parallel with all this, there's yet another plane mm-hmm. with all this. And that was ASMS.
Okay. So you were...
I became secretary. Mm-hmm. It's on my...
CD. Yeah, we can get the dates out of the...
So I was secretary, and then vice president, then I had... because I was then president-elect, that made me vice president for the program mm-hmm. for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So then I had those two. Then I was 2 years as president. Then mm-hmm. I was 2 years as
past president.
Mm-hmm. It was only when all that was finished that I realized by going to the meetings that I really hadn't gone to the meetings very much in my huge amount of time.
Yeah.
Because there was no staff.
Yeah.
Whoa. Now, wait a minute. At the time it was E14 and all of that, everything was done by
volunteers
or living off of somebody's secretary mm-hmm. or doing something. But you didn't have a dedicated staff
right.
to get things done. So people who made the programs, did things with the programs, did a lot of copy work and folding papers and yakking on the phone. To arrange this, arrange that. So my job at that stage was, let me think when that was, I can look. I started making phone calls to, and I looked up this other societies, the names of other societies, national mm-hmm. societies, of about the same size, mm-hmm. not that radically different, mm-hmm. and called them with a proposal to ask them if they'd like to go join. Mm-hmm. What if we share the office? Mm-hmm. We have a person running all that, and we paid into it, and you paid into it by some formula, and the workers on, and hopefully they would already have a place.
Mm-hmm.
So we just say, well, we'll just pick up part of the rent and go on with that. And so that was quite interesting. That was a real education for me because I talked to a lot of people in other societies of all kinds.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how they operated, but I found out by discussing
mm-hmm.
their business with them about what went where. And I came upon Judith Watson,
mm-hmm.
and I hired her.
Mm-hmm.
So Judith Watson was now Judith Schoberg.
Right.
At the time, she was, I guess she was married to Jack Watson.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. that had neither here nor there to do with her working for ASMS.
Okay.
But she was working for an eye institute, an eye institute of some kind. And, running their program and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got together and realized after a little while that we were talking about a job that would suit her very well with her personality and with mm-hmm. her experience level, and that we were certainly in need of help.
Yeah.
I was drowning in my second year as vice president for programs.
Yeah.
We had to have those things printed.
Yeah.
And folded up. And remember the St. Louis meeting?
Yes.
That was when I was on the plane flying to St. Louis and opened up the program, which I had printed by then, thank God. And realized that it was wrong. Big pieces had been left out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called, who did I call at that point? Jerry Mizell or somebody,
mm-hmm.
and said, there's bad news.
mm-hmm.
The programs that were delivered yesterday by freight,
mm-hmm.
air freight to the hotel.
Yeah.
The hotel was. I remember being around.
Yeah, it's down Riverfront, one of the Riverfront hotels.
That's right.
It's changed names three or four times, or owners or whatever.
Those won't work. And so the printer was at fault. And the printer knew it. And the printer agreed to have them redone and send us big pieces for the center.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got there, several of us went and ripped apart the programs for a whole night. I don't know how long it took.
Mm.
We ripped out the centerpieces and put in the new ones and stapled them. Oh my gosh, that was a nightmare.
Yeah, that would have been.
Judith was not yet into.
She wasn't in that point. Mix.
That was at the tail end of.
It was when you decided you did.
Of my sanity at that point. Realizing that these are things that can be taken care of by a staff person if they're good. And I should have, I could have, I guess, checked all those things at the printer when I picked them up.
Mm-hmm.
But, whoa, I had other irons in the fire.
Oh, yeah.
Going through those wasn't part of it, but now I learned.
Well, being part of the shop that runs the meeting, you end up missing a lot of the conference, some of the scientific because you're always running around. Yeah.
And we're always having meetings of the board of directors and who is going to check the suites to find out who's not in compliance with which rule.
Yeah.
There are a list of rules.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who can do what and what.
And
this went on and on, and we were, I was vice president for program, we were the ones who had to enforce this.
Yeah.
And go and tell them,
can't do this.
Can't
do this.
Yeah.
And I thought, God. So, one I thought was a major accomplishment, but it didn't occur to me as being that until much later, was hiring her.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gave the society something that it really needed. And it let the society recruit by one means or another its officers without,
mm-hmm.
if they were too smart, they would find out that there's a lot of work associated with this stuff. If they weren't so smart, they were better off because they could work on
I've got the figures. I don't know what they are offhand, but I guess the meeting at that time, size-wise, would have been in the multiple 500, 600, 700s, I guess. Would it be as much as 1,000? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually have the numbers. I have to check that out.
500 or 600.
Okay.
500 or 600, and.
And that was a big deal. We can count that back.
Like I said, I can.
Big deal. We had all kinds of hotel problems.
Yeah.
One of them was the time we were set to meet
in Houston.
In Houston, at the Rice Hotel.
Right.
And someone called me. Oh, no, Pam Crane is the one who spotted. She says, I just looked at an article in the Victoria Advocate, and it says that the Rice Hotel is closing. What?
Yeah, right.
We had no idea. They never informed us. Mm-hmm. Just we were back to square one.
Yeah.
And so that was a panic.
Oh, yeah.
Time. And
we
pulled it out, but it was...
That was a Shamrock. I remember going to that conference. We had to end up at a Shamrock Hotel. And the only reason we got the guys were able to get us in there was because it was Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was the beginning.
But that was the first of many Memorial Day weekends because we found out that was the lead
hard
example.
One. Yeah.
But you can get all kinds of deals. You can get into hotels you couldn't get into otherwise. The rates will be 20% less. And so forth. And of course, that was taken. All those decisions at that time were made by the officers, in particular the vice president for programming, touring around and saying, "I like this hotel better than this one. Let's line up the issues."
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
So finally, we got rid of that onerous job by having a staff.
When you proposed the idea of hiring someone like Judith to run the kind of like nuts and bolts day-to-day business of the society, how did the board, was that a popular idea amongst the board members at the time, or were they more or less?
It was popular. They talked about it, and they knew I was out fishing around. It wasn't quite clear how this was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
What are the financial arrangements?
Yeah.
Is this a deal or not a deal?
Yeah.
And I said, gosh, it's a step up. No matter how you slice it, it's a step up. Mm-hmm. We have to do it.
Yeah.
And
no, I mean, it would be impossible today to do it under the old way where you had, you know, a volunteer staff that did everything. That would be totally disastrous.
Oh, boy. It used to be, you just, I remember. Anyway, I had the honor of being the first vice president for programs who rejected an abstract.
Oh, wow.
That had never been done before. That tells you something. I got this nonsense. What's that guy's name? Nonsense abstract.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to take mass spectrometers and run them to see which one was better here, better there, and post about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to call him up and say, this is not research. This is not stuff you want to report at. Anyway, so, no.
Mm. Yeah, because they never hardly ever rejected an abstract. I mean, they do on a pretty regular basis, but not in the past. They hardly ever rejected abstracts. I think mostly what they're trying to do is keep out advertisements for instruments.
Kay points out I was not an ASMS officer at the time of Houston. I was
when they
recruited me to be secretary.
That sets
the dates. The dating frame then moves a little bit. Okay. Anyway, the ASMS thing was a parallel deal to everything we're talking about because it didn't require science, it didn't require whatever, but it was a
time consuming,
and it was a contribution to the community.
Did you get any recognition from Utah from that? I mean, did they give you a little pat on the back for it, or did they recognize that as being something that was worth having you do and give any?
No, I mean, I already had tenure.
Yeah,
I couldn't. I didn't get a raise.
Did you ever teach any classes at Utah?
Yeah, I taught some analytical biochemistry classes to the pharmacy students early on when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And that
sealed my conviction that I was not.
You were not meant to be a teacher.
I was not meant to be for that course. Mm-hmm. And I had no interest in the pharmacy program and how it worked. And that was at a time when the pharmacy program was changing radically, and they were making what's called a PharmD program.
PharmD?
Doctor of Pharmacy.
Oh, okay.
And so you had then the undergraduates who were there for 5 years, and you had then the others who were picking up on this new thing. And endless hours spent in committee meetings trying to decide how to do that. Right? I mean, just, you know, I was spared that because I aced myself out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I had a, whatever it is, biomedical instrumentation course that I invented and talked for mass spectrometry. And I had an NMR guy come in, faculty member, and do an NMR section and that sort of thing. That was a graduate level class, and mm-hmm. it lasted for quite a while, actually. And I ran it for quite a while. But it wasn't a draw on my time like it would be if I taught a real pharmacy class.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, right? Mm-hmm. 5 times a week, and whoa, don't
mm-hmm.
you?
mm-hmm. So you do like 3-hour courses, mm-hmm. yeah. And did you teach that for a long time, or was that just?
That one was for a long time. I was more than a decade. I
think. Oh, okay.
And then
the enrollment was what? A handful of people, a bunch, or
taking the course.
Yeah, taking the course.
8 to 14.
Oh, okay.
Is my recollection.
Okay, so a friendly group.
Yeah. That's right.
Now, is Utah a state school?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So is that another one of these land-grant schools that you know, or?
Oh, that's Utah State.
That's Utah State.
Utah State is a land-grant. So the University of Utah is a state school, but not a land-grant.
That's correct.
And the enrollment typically?
22,000.
Okay. So it's the typical
size for that.
Yeah.
But not these humongous things, right?
No.
60,000.
Yeah. Like University of Texas.
yeah. Nobody knows what's happening on the other.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Which to me would not be very comfortable.
Okay, well, you want to take a break here and do the lunch thing?
Yeah, let's do a lunch thing.
Lunch.
Okay, what have we done? We've gotten through.